You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday. That means it is time for Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, although Vermonters are very proud and pleased to call him their own, Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. We've had a lot going on in the Middle East, and the campaigns are really heating up, and the fiscal cliff is coming. What are your thoughts on these?
Well, first, obviously, I think all of us want to express our condolences to the family of Chris Stevens. I've had a chance as a member of Congress and the Senate to get around the world a little bit and to visit American embassies. And I'll tell you, Tom, I'm always impressed by the high-quality work that many of our folks do around the world, economically, politically. Many of them know the native language. They're serious people. And obviously it is a tragedy when one of them loses, more than one of them, when a number of them lose their lives to just a horrendously brutal and attack. So our hearts go out to those families. In the United States now, there is, right back home, we are in the midst of a very serious campaign, one of the more important elections in my lifetime. And I think the one point that I would like to make to listeners is I think many of us get turned off by campaigns. We get turned off by media superficiality. We get turned off by the negative advertising and the huge amount of 30-second ads, especially in the battleground states. But I think in the midst of all of that, we have got to understand how important this election is about. And I think, if you ask me, Tom, what I think the most important characteristic of this particular election is about is the degree to how far right the Republican Party has gone. The Republican Party today, I think it is fair to say, has become a right-wing extremist party funded by a small number of billionaires like the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and a handful of others, and appealing to a very, very extremist base. And, you know, we see every day what their beliefs are. And sometimes the media does not pay as much attention to that reality as they should. But for a start, I think everybody knows, and the media has recently reported, that the middle class in this country continues to shrink. Poverty remains at over 46 million Americans, some 15% of our population, while the very wealthiest people continue to do phenomenally well, and the gap between the people on top and everybody else grows wider. Now, in the middle of all of that, how many people think it makes sense for what Romney and Ryan are proposing, and that is huge tax breaks for the very wealthiest people in this country, increasing the deficit? And then at the same time, while they give huge tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, increase the deficit, they propose to make very significant cuts in Social Security, veterans benefits, Medicare, basically ending Medicare as we know it, Medicaid, education. So many of our young people today finding it very, very hard, A, to go to college, and if they go to college and graduate, they're leaving school deeply in debt. These guys want to cut back on Pell Grants and other student assistance programs, nutrition programs. Sometimes it is easy to forget, but millions of people today are struggling to put food on their tables, senior citizens, people trying to take care of kids. And they want to cut back on nutrition programs. So I think that is not what America is about. And that's what extremism is about, giving tax breaks to the people who need it the least and cutting back on programs desperately needed by people who are struggling today is not, in my view, what America is supposed to be about. You know, but it's not just the economy. If you look at issues like women's rights, I understand in my state and all over this country there are differences of opinion about abortion, but I don't think that there are terribly many Americans who agree with the plank in the Republican platform, which says that if you're a woman And if you were raped, that you must have the rapist baby, must have it, because they want to bring forth a constitutional amendment to force women to have a rapist baby, even if it means the health or the life of that woman. And that is, Tom, what extremism is about. And then you have an issue like global warming. 98% of the scientists who have written peer-reviewed articles on climate change believe, A, that global warming is real, B, that it is significantly caused by human activity, and C, that it is already causing serious damage to our planet. If the Republicans gain control over the Senate, the senator who will be chairman of the Environmental Committee, which has jurisdiction over global warming, is Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma. And Jim believes that global warming is a hoax perpetrated on the American people by Al Gore, the United Nations, and the Hollywood elite. That is what Senator Inhofe believes, and he will be in charge of dealing with global warming if the Republicans gain control over the Senate. So where we are right now is with a party, the Republican Party, that has moved very far to the right on economic issues, in my view, very much beholden to the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations. They have moved very, very far to the right on social issues, certainly including women's rights, very far to the right on environmental issues, including global warming. And if that party wins the White House, if that party gains control over the Senate, I worry very, very much about the future of this country. When we have 50 million Americans today who have no health insurance, what we have to do is go beyond the Affordable Care Act and do what the rest of the industrialized world does and say that health care is a right for all of our people. What these Republicans want to do is end the Affordable Care Act and make massive cuts in Medicaid, which would throw millions of children off of health insurance and make middle-class people suffer, because people may not know it. But when folks have to send their parents to a nursing home because that parent may have Alzheimer's or some other very terrible illness, Medicaid very, very often picks up a lot of that cost. And if you make devastating cuts to Medicaid, that expense is going to fall back on those middle-class families. So I think if you go beyond the hoopla and the media stuff, which is often very superficial, and the negative ads out there, just take a hard look at what we should really be analyzing. What do the Republicans stand for in terms of creating the millions of jobs this country desperately needs? What are they going to do about health care? What are they going to do about the environment? What are they going to do about protecting women's rights? I think if you look at those issues very coldly and matter-of-factly and analyze what these guys are talking about, what you see is right-wing extremism, something which would be a disaster for this country.
Yeah. And Mitt Romney this morning on ABC News said the middle class is $200,000 to $250,000 annual income.
Did he really?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that. Well, that just, that just indicates to what degree this fella is out of touch with reality in America. I remember a number of months ago when he made the statement about the high cost of college education, and his brilliant remark was, go ask your parents for the money to send you to college. Be bold.
Right.
Not understanding that millions of families in this country simply don't have the money. Their parents are not, kids' parents are not wealthy.
Yeah, absolutely. 15 minutes past the hour, we'll be back with your calls for Senator Sanders on Brunch with Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls at our national town hall meeting for the rest of the hour. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov.
But while we guard our shores against threats of war, we will continue to remove the causes of unrest and antagonism at home, which might make our people more easy victims to those for whom foreign war is profitable.
Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. His website, sanders.senate.gov. And Craig in Los Angeles, watching on Free Speech TV, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Hi, Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum a little bit. I'm a fiscal conservative, social moderate. And I guess my question to the senator that I'd like to hear him answer is, at what point as a nation are we going to stop an automatic 8% growth of government? We clearly are spending more money than we have coming in. This is over and above the tax ramifications with the old Bush taxes, Bush tax cuts going away. I want to get your answer as to how we can continue 8% growth of government. We have to cut the growth of government, not just cut programs, but the growth of government. Please respond.
Well, Craig, thanks for the question. I look at the issue a little bit differently. When we talk about growth of government programs in the midst of a recession, what we are including is a significant increase in funding for unemployment compensation. And the reason we're doing that is that real unemployment in this country today is close to 15%. And I think it would not only be immoral, but bad economics to simply cut the lifeline for people who are unemployed. So if the question is, should we continue to make sure that people who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own continue to be able to afford the basic necessities of life? Yeah, I do. Will it cost us money? Yes, it will. The same principle in terms of food stamps. I know some of my Republican friends make the point that food stamp costs have gone up. Well, they have gone up. And they have gone up because we are in the midst of a serious recession and more people are struggling to be able to put food on their table. And I think as a society, based on moral, civilized principles, we must not let elderly people, we must not let children go hungry. We are living in a society where until very, very recently, more and more people were losing their health insurance. Craig, I think you know in California, in Vermont, all over this country, you have employers who are, for a variety of reasons, increasingly not providing decent health insurance or any health insurance to their worker. So we're faced with a situation, what do we do if children have no health insurance because their parents don't have health insurance on the job? Do we allow those kids to get ill or perhaps die because they can't get to a doctor when they need? I don't think so. I think you have to expand Medicaid. So my point is that in the midst of especially a severe recession like we're in right now, yeah, you are going to have to expend money on programs that provide basic necessities to our children, to our seniors, and to those people who are hurting. But, Craig, I think the issue is not just the cost of government. I think one of the things we also want to look at is that as a result of this Wall Street-caused recession, revenue, i.e., the amount of money coming into the government, is at, compared to GDP, the lowest point it has been in some 60 years. It's about 15.2% compared to GDP. And to my mind, what we have got to understand is that has everything to do with this Wall Street-caused recession, with businesses going under, with workers losing their job and not paying taxes. And at a time when we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and that gap between the people on top and everybody else is growing wider, I think we have to increase revenue by asking the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations to, in fact, pay more in taxes. That is what we have to do. So I think, Craig, to answer your question, you have to look within the context of what is happening in the country, a massive recession, which has led to people losing their homes, their jobs, their life savings, people struggling by the millions to keep their heads above water economically. At the same time, revenue has declined because of the Wall Street-caused recession. Thirdly, the people on top and large corporations are doing phenomenally well, and they are going to have to contribute to deficit reduction, and they are going to have to contribute to make sure that the most vulnerable people in this country can live in dignity.
Wayne in Schaumburg, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon. I wanted to comment about the ramifications of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. More than 600 representatives of corporations are privy to what's going on inside the negotiations. Senators are not allowed to know what's going on. People in the House of Representatives are not allowed to know what's going on. Actually, what it looks like is NAFTA on steroids, because American corporations will continue to be subject to U.S. laws and regulations. But
Wayne, we just have a minute left. Let's get Senator Sanders' response.
Well, I think Wayne makes a good point. Wayne makes an important point, and I hope people pay attention to the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership. He is right. This is a continuation of the trade policies, which include NAFTA, CAFTA, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, and other trade agreements, which by and large have been very, very bad for American workers, have helped contribute to the loss of many, many tens of thousands of factories in this country in the last 10 years, and the loss of millions of decent-paying jobs. So I share Wayne's concern about the secrecy in terms of developing this trade agreement, and once again forcing American workers to compete against people in Vietnam and in other countries who make pennies an hour.
This has not yet been presented to Congress in any way, is that correct?
That is correct. Wayne is right. I have talked to the Trade Representative's office about this issue, but it has not been made public.
Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting, with Senator Sanders taking your calls on any topic you want. Give him a call. And we'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. And you can check out Tom Hartman, our website at tomhartman.com, up into our live chat room and see. Welcome back. Program that's fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman and Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It is our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Frank in Port Charlotte, Florida, you are on the air with Senator Sanders. Frank?
Hello?
Hey, Frank, you're on the air with Bernie.
Bernie. Senator
Bernie.
How
are you, Frank?
I just love you as an independent. I want to thank you very much for your service. But do you remember when Paulson and Benarek went before Congress and cried those big tears?
I remember it very well.
Yeah, and then they got their money, and they gave it to the banks. And Paulson told the banks they had to take it, whether they wanted it or not. And then when the banks got the money, they held on to it, and they haven't put out a dime to help those people who were talking about toxic mortgages. This is what it was supposed to be for. But why didn't somebody in Congress see this? Why didn't they notice that Benarek and Paulson were lying through their teeth?
Well, Frank, some of us did notice what was going on, and some of us, including myself, voted against that bailout. And some of us today are fighting for real Wall Street reform, which would include, among other things, fundamental changes in the way the Fed does oversight over Wall Street, and also breaking up the largest financial institutions in this country, which today have too much power and too much money. I think, Tom, I'm glad Frank asked that question, because it is my absolute belief that we are not going to create the economy this country needs. We're not going to save the middle class in this country unless we deal with Wall Street. And right now, Wall Street is a world unto itself, and an enormously powerful world, where six of the largest financial institutions have assets equivalent to two-thirds of the GDP of the United States, over $9 trillion. Six financial institutions led by J.P. Morgan Chase. They write half of the mortgages and two-thirds of the credit cards. And they have so much money and they have so much power that when you talk about the relationship between Wall Street and Congress, it is not, trust me, Congress that regulates Wall Street. It is much truer that that Wall Street regulates Congress and has enormous power over Congress through lobbying efforts and campaign contributions. Bottom line here is Wall Street has incredible amounts of money. The demand must be that our financial institutions do, as Frank just suggested, get the money out into the productive economic sector where businesses need money to expand, produce products, create services, and create jobs. And what we have got to do is end the gambling casino that is Wall Street, where through incredibly complicated and often illegal behavior, they make money only for themselves. They are not part of the productive real economy that helps us create the jobs we desperately need. So I would say to Frank that as somebody who took on Alan Greenspan and Robert Rubin during the Clinton years, when they told us how great Wall Street deregulation was, who voted against this Wall Street bailout, who has proposed probably the most significant Fed reform legislation, who wants to break up these large financial institutions, I do have a sense of what's going on. But right now we've got to rally the American people into understanding that if Wall Street remains as it is today, an island unto itself, interested only in its own profits, not concerned about the rest of our economy, we are not going to rebuild the middle class of this country.
Lee in Duval, Washington, listening on Talk 1090 in Seattle. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Bernie and Tom. How you guys doing? I want to talk about some real money here, Bernie. How about $2.3 trillion that Donald Rumsfeld talked about on September the 10th? And on September the 11th, the wing of the Pentagon that was struck by the plane, missile, whatever it was that hit it, was the accounting department that was investigating the missing funds. And so I was wondering if the Congress is investigating that, plus the $8.8 or $10 billion, whatever is missing from in cash that was missing from Iraq. I want to know if Congress is on the trail of these or if they just let these things go because the neocons just don't want to be bothered. The neocons who are now reconstituted in the U.S. Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, too, by the way. Can you let me know if Congress is on the trail or are they just letting this money disappear?
Well, Lee, thanks for raising that issue. My recollection, and it's interesting, Lee is right in saying that Rumsfeld, the day before 9/11, was speaking about, as I understand it, Lee, the enormous waste and unaccountable funds within the Defense Department. The Defense Department has a budget of $700 billion a year. And frankly, they don't have the accounting capability and the computers to tell the American people where that money is going and how it is being spent. I can tell you, as somebody who has investigated aspects of that problem, that we know that in warehouses around this country, there are billions and billions of dollars of spare parts that the military will never use. They're not needed. Just billions of dollars that were ordered and will never be used. We also know, and we've investigated this, it's a point that Lee didn't make, that virtually every major defense contractor has been engaged in fraud against the United States government and the Defense Department, or has reached settlements with the Defense Department and paid significant fines. We also know that there time and time and time again, when defense contractors make bids for defense systems, they grossly underestimate what the project ends up costing, and they make far more than they had originally proposed to make. So Lee's point is a very important point, especially when we look at deficit reduction. And Lee, what I would say to you is that right now, despite the fact that we've seen a tripling of defense spending since 1997, and we're now spending almost as much money as the rest of the world combined on defense, You have folks, certainly in the Republican Party, and some Democrats, who think we need to spend even more on defense. And I think that makes no sense at all. So Lee's point is exactly right. Right now, we do not know. We do not have a strong accounting system within the Department of Defense. And second of all, we have every reason to believe that there is an enormous amount of waste and duplication. And that is an issue that I and others are looking at. But it ain't so easy to get all the facts.
Ryan in Fox Lake, Illinois, listening on WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Mr. Hartman, Mr. Sanders. It's a pleasure to be on the air with both of you. I have agreed with almost or pretty much everything that Mr. Sanders said from the beginning until now. My question is, don't you think it's equally important for the election of Congress members or congressmen, or if not more important than the election of the president?
Well, I don't, Ryan, I don't think it's more or less important. Both are very important. Obviously, who the president of the United States is, you know, by definition, enormously important. On the other hand, it is equally important that we have a strong and progressive House of Representatives and a strong and progressive United States Senate. I would hope very much, let me take that question to move into another area of great importance, and to say that what concerns me is that our right-wing friends and our Tea Party friends pay a whole lot of attention to candidates and to elections. And in fact, I think one has got to congratulate the right wing in this country, who in the last 10 years have moved the Republican Party from a what I would call a right-center party into a right-wing extremist party. On the other hand, I think progressives do not get engaged in the political process about who is elected to the House, who is elected to the Senate, in anywhere near the degree that the right wing does. I think a lot of progressives say, oh, you know, I don't care what's going on in Washington. It's all crap. I'm not going to pay any attention. And yet, by not getting active, they allow some bad people to get elected and allow good people to lose elections. So Ryan's point is extremely important. And where we are right now, today, is the U.S. Senate is up for grabs. Right now, the Democrats have a three-seat advantage. And I caucus with the Democrats, and Lieberman is with the Democratic caucus as well. And we don't know how that's going to shake out. It is possible the Republicans could gain control over the Senate. The punditry seems to think that the Republicans will retain control over the House, maybe with a smaller majority. And that's where we are right now. So Ryan's point is absolutely right. People have got to focus on who's running for Congress in their district and who's running for the United States Senate.
It's Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our Brunch with Bernie Hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie in just a moment. 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out Bernie's website over at Sanders.Senate.gov. Be right back with more of your calls for Bernie. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. Bill in Clifton, New Jersey, listening on WWRL out of New York City. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello. My question is, given that the best revenue, best way to bring revenue right now is to drop all the Bush tax cuts on everybody and to put back some middle-class tax cuts like that were taken away by Reagan, like being able to deduct interest on personal loans and credit card interest. People are being killed with 20% card interest. Why can't they write that off? And the other one was if they could write off their entire mortgage, principal, and interest, that would be great for the housing business.
Well, Bill, I think what you're really talking about is coming up in general with a tax system that is fair. And that is progressive. and which says that when we have the top 1% of this country owning 41% of the wealth, while the bottom 60% own 2.3% of the wealth, that maybe we should be moving toward a more progressive tax system. The last study that I've seen between 2009 and 2010 is that 93% of all new income went to the top 1%. And in fact, today, the effective, i.e. real tax rate for people on top is the lowest that it has been in decades. So I think what we do need to do, both in terms of fairness for the middle class and in terms of deficit reduction, is to come up with a progressive tax system. Now, I don't agree with you, Bill, that we should end all of the Bush tax breaks. I think if you tell the middle class today that they're going to have to pay substantially more in taxes at a time when many folks have seen a decline in their wages and in their family income, in some cases have lost their jobs, I think that would be a painful slap at millions and millions of people. But clearly, we have got to end the tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country. We must do away with the situation where you have one quarter of profitable corporations today paying nothing in taxes, and other very, very profitable corporations paying extremely little, where we're losing about $100 billion every single year because of tax havens in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, where these corporations stash their money to avoid taxes. So bottom line is we need a tax system which protects the middle class, which starts asking the wealthiest people and large corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. And that's the kind of progressive tax system that some of us are fighting for.
Reginald in Houston, Texas, watching on Free Speech TV and Dish Network. You're on the air with Bernie.
Tom, I wish you well, and you wish you well in your wellness. And speaking of wellness, you know, the senior citizens who are desperately in need of a cost of living raise, and it was a couple of years before they just got one this year. They're having to pay for their medical and the food and utilities out of this year, and I haven't seen Congress or the Senate address this at all. And they'll be turning around and asking these people for their vote, and they're in the dire needs, you know, living in third world conditions. And I wonder, since yesterday we had the 9/11 2 days ago with all the incidents that happened, the oversights and no accountability, is that worth having an investigation, you know, like Great Britain did? Because, you know, we have these militia groups going on, we got hate groups, we got divide and conquer. And I wonder if we, you know, we come together as a repentant nation, maybe we'll get favor from God back on that. Can you address those two issues, Bernie?
Well, Reginald, you've asked me a lot. Let me go back to the Kohler issue. And Reginald is exactly correct. In the last 3 years, just this last year, seniors have gotten the Kohler. I think it was around 3%. The previous 2 years,
they got no
cost of living adjustment, right. And the previous 2 years, they did not get a cost of living adjustment. Now, I want to say two things to you, Reginald. Understand that right now, not only are many members of Congress, certainly the Republicans and some Democrats, not only are they not looking at ways to make sure that seniors get a fair COLA, which reflects their increased expenses, often on health care and prescription drugs, what they want to do is cut COLAs through a concept called the chain CPI, which would reformulate COLAs and result in seniors having significantly smaller COLAs than is currently the case. I have introduced legislation that would do exactly the opposite, that would say to seniors that the needs of seniors' purchasing habits are different than 18-year-olds and should not be lumped together. People, when they're 70 or 75 and up, buying flat-screen TVs and computers and iPhones. What they are buying is prescription drugs and health care needs. And those costs have gone up, while many other costs have gone down. We need a segregated index for seniors to look at exactly what they are spending money on, and that's legislation that I've introduced as part of the Older Americans Act.
Bernie, we have about a minute and a half left. I'm not sure it's enough time to bring in a
call.
Well,
let's try one more, Tom. Maybe we'll make it. If you have one, do you have one on the...
Sure. There's a whole bunch of them here. Dave in Murphy's, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie, and thank you for your citizenship and helping stoke one of the most informative shows in America. I have one statement question, a quick short one. Since we see the Republican Congress making laws which give them their own socialized medicine while complaining about Obamacare, writing laws that give tax breaks to mega corporations that pay no taxes and taking super PAC dollars free elections, since Congress gives themselves immunity to profit from insider trading, speculating on Wall Street, hence no energy policy, and since most of all Congress has no children in the military, is it reasonable to believe many of the Republican Congress are treating their elected jobs as self-serving private practice rather than honorable public service? And
Bernie?
When did economic...
Okay, I think I've got just, the
we're just got out
question,
of time.
Dave. I would look at it a little bit differently. And some of what you said is actually not accurate. Bottom line here is, and the most important issue that we have got to focus on, is the degree to which big money controls the political process in this country and the degree to which candidates and incumbent politicians are dependent upon big money to get elected and end up having to do their bidding, the bidding of big money, rather than the middle class and working families of this country. That is, to my mind, the defining issue in terms of what's going on politically in America today.
Right on the button. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great to have you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Congressman Adam Smith of the great state of Washington, representing the 9th District of that state, is on the line with us. He is the ranking member for the Armed Services Committee in the House of Representatives. Congressman Smith, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate the chance.
I'm curious, as the ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, I'm curious about your thoughts on, what's going on in the Middle East and the domestic politics of it, how Mitt Romney has tried to turn this into something to beat up President Obama with, and it looks to me like the only adult in the room is Barack Obama. But I'm curious your thoughts on this.
That's been absolutely clear since this began, and I mean it's just a whole series of very disturbing things. With the prospect of Mitt Romney being commander in chief, if this is how he's going to handle situations like this. I mean, his initial statement, came out very prematurely, was completely wrong on its facts, and he never backed down from it. But even more than that, I mean, the overall rhetoric that Mr. Romney has used throughout this campaign, basically his foreign policy is going to be the United States ought to force by its military, I guess, or by, sheer will, our way on the whole rest of the world. He actually had this very disturbing quote where he said, President Obama likes to say that there's a lot of countries out there that we have a lot of common in, a lot in common with. And Mitt Romney said, well, I disagree with that. So I think his vision is that America basically forces the rest of the world to do what we want it to do, and that's just not the way the world works. It's very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
How does he propose to do that? So beyond just sort of the fumbling around of not being able to have a clear message that matches with the facts, you see the neocon. I mean, he makes George W. Bush look like a pacifist at this point with some of the language that he's throwing out there about how he would confront Syria and Iran and even China and Russia, for that matter. I think it's a dangerous foreign policy in addition to an incoherent one.
Your thoughts as the ranking member on the Armed Services Committee on what is going on in the Middle East and how we should respond to this. Could it be that it's time for, or perhaps there should have been after the Arab Spring, I know it would have been very difficult to get through Congress with the Republicans in charge, but should there have been some small version of a Marshall Plan to give these people some sense that life is getting better now that they've overthrown their dictators?
Well, we've done some of that. I mean, we do have some aid programs, but they're very, very small at this point, I'm afraid. So, I think, yes, we have to try and engage. And we also have to be mindful of the fact that that part of the world does not trust us. Our credibility with those folks is very low. So we have to move very cautiously and very slowly. And I mean, part of it is, and I know, Mitt Romney would hate this phrase, but we have to have some humility about that part of the world. It's a dangerous place right now, but the U.S. can't simply decide they're going to fix it. And whether it's, you know, spending a lot of money or sending it in the military, we can't automatically create civil governments in other parts of the world, particularly in the Middle East, where, you know, they have some very big problems, both economic and in terms of governance, and where they don't trust us, where we don't have a very strong relationship because historically we backed a lot of the very dictators that they were trying to overthrow. So it's a place where we're going to have to recognize the dangers and be cautious and do what we can to move towards greater stability and also try to get some international partners to help us with that. The U.S. alone is not going to be able to fix it. But if there are other nations in the world that have a stake in peace and stability, and there are, we should look for ways to partner with them to be helpful to this, to the Middle East and North Africa.
We're talking with Congressman Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington's 9th District, U.S. member of the House of Representatives, ranking member of the Armed Services Committee. You know, about the campaign here, BarackObama.com, of course, the website for the Obama campaign. And to that, if you don't mind talking about politics here for a minute, Congressman, I'm curious, Mitt Romney has literally, you know, $1 billion behind him that has been raised from, yeah. We just had Senator Sanders on. He said they've identified now either 23 or 26, I forget which was the number, billionaires who have committed at least $250,000 each to the Romney campaign or to the super PACs that are attacking the president. It looks like this will be literally the first presidential election in the history of the United States in which an incumbent president is going to be outspent by a challenger. Not to mention, you know, all the right wing infrastructure, Fox News and the right wing talk shows and everything else. How does that all play out? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, you know, it's a reminder that even though President Obama right now is looking good, I mean, I think clearly the Democratic convention went better than the Republican convention in terms of delivering a cohesive message that the American people could relate to, which was basically middle class opportunity, and our commitment to trying to make that happen. You know, we're in good shape in that regard, but the money that's going to be spent in these last, gosh, what are we down to now, about seven and a half weeks, could shift that. Now, the good news is that President Obama does have a lot of money. He doesn't have as much as they do, to be sure. But, you know, he's got a lot of money, a lot of grassroots organizations. Basically, you got to go out there and fight it out. But it also points out to the desperate need for campaign finance reform and a constitutional amendment to correct what I think are the mistakes of the Supreme Court. Corporations are not people, and money should not be equivalent to speech. And those rulings have really handicapped our ability to stop our elections simply going to the highest bidder. And I know, you know, Senator Sanders has been a leader on that. Yes. And many others in the House have as well. That's a battle we're going to have to keep fighting.
Yeah. Isn't that, frankly, hasn't the Citizens United and several rulings before that, I mean, First National Bank versus, yeah, Bilotti, Buckley versus Vallejo and others, aren't they really paving the way toward oligarchy, a real distortion of small d democracy and a small r republic?
Absolutely. And I mean, they've even gone so far as to strike down, you know, Arizona had a great public financing law. They had statewide elections where, you know, candidates actually didn't have to raise any money. They could actually, you know, focus on issues, focus on, you know, telling voters their message. And the Supreme Court struck down that law. Based on those opinions that you just mentioned. So, no, it's a bad situation. But look, I mean, you got to play on the field that's in front of you. Mm. And yes, Republicans are going to have a lot of money, but I think the president's the better candidate, clearly. He's got the better message, both in terms of a domestic economic agenda, and then as we saw this week, when foreign policy crops up, you know, just like, you know, he showed during a crisis in 2008, he knows how to handle that crisis much, much, much better than certainly John McCain did 4 years ago or Mitt Romney does now. And quite frankly, for the first time in my memory, Democrats have an advantage on national security questions when you ask the American people who they trust more. So I think we need to play up that advantage for all it's worth, and show that the president is a reasonable steward of our national security interests. And we have no idea what we're going to get from Mitt Romney.
Why do you say no idea? Because he's been on so many sides of so many issues for the last 20 years?
Well, no, because his position, number one, he has no foreign policy experience, no foreign policy record. And then you look at Afghanistan. What's he going to do in Afghanistan? He didn't say anything about it at the convention. He has no policy.
Well, he was in France during the Vietnam War.
That is true. He's vaguely upset about what's going on in the Middle East and North Africa, but he has presented no plan. You know, he's upset that we're, quote, not doing more in Syria, whatever that might mean, but he commits to no specific plan. And then, frankly, one of my concerns is, given the belligerence of his rhetoric about how it's shameful that America isn't leading, that President Obama isn't putting us out front, I mean, how many more wars does he want to get us into to put America out front? I think it's both unknown and what we do know about it. It's quite frightening. So I'm hoping that message will drive home and people will see it, and the president's lead in the polls will continue straight through November 6th.
Yeah, I hope so too. And if so, it'll be like the California elections with Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina. It'll be a rare example of people power triumphing over money power, and that would be fine thing to see.
Money doesn't always win. That's something to keep in mind and keep working hard.
There you go. Congressman Adam Smith of the great state of Washington, thank you so much, sir, for being with us today.
Thanks for the chance. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And people can check out the president's website at barackobama.com. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're going to go into Anything Goes Friday now. Pick up your calls on whatever topic is on your mind.
In olden days, a slim's a stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Welcome back. Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. Taya in Blackfoot, Idaho. Hey, Taya. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. It's really worthwhile to wait to get to talk to you.
Thank you.
I have something that's really been bothering me. I live here in Idaho, and, of course, it's a real Republican stronghold. Just this year, they passed a new ruling where they go with the party primary, mm-hmm. where you have to declare your party in order to vote.
Right.
There's very few individuals running as independents or Democrats in the state. Mm-hmm. So it really ties your hand if you happen to be one. In fact, there were five men running for sheriff of our town, and all five of them were Republicans. So unless I declared I was a Republican, I couldn't vote for any of them. So it's almost like taxation without representation.
Well, you need to run for sheriff, Taya.
Yeah, that would be good. That would be good. But my question is, I see this as voter suppression. I do. And I'm sure there's a lot of people in a lot of Republican stronghold states that have the same problem when they go to vote, you know, unless they declare. And I even understand here in Idaho, they were having them sign a form saying that they would vote Republican in the general election, too. Now, hopefully they didn't do that. I didn't even go and vote. I was so upset about the whole thing. It's the first time I haven't voted in years.
Oh, my. Well, I think you should. If I may respectfully disagree with you, I grew up in Michigan, which was an open primary state. What we're talking about here is the difference between closed primary states and open primary states. In a closed primary state, you must be registered as a member of a party in order to vote in that party's primary. In an open primary state, anybody can vote in either party's primaries. And when I was a kid in Michigan, the Republicans wanted to really badly mess with the Democrats, and I think it was the election of 68, as I recall, although I'd have to go back and look. But that would have been the election of, where it was Humphrey versus Nixon. And the Republicans wanted to so badly mess with the Democrats that when it wasn't Lester Maddox, it was George Wallace. George Wallace was running for president in the Democratic primary. And so all the Republicans Republicans were talking about this on the radio. All the Republicans went out and voted in the Democratic primary for George Wallace. And it was a huge embarrassment for the state of Michigan and nationally for the entire Democratic Party that Michigan actually sent George Wallace as their candidate to the national convention. Michigan, you know, the majority of, quote, Democrats, and it was actually Republicans in the quote, Democratic primary, because in the Republican primary, they already knew it was going to be Nixon, or, you know, they already knew who their candidate was going to be. So they voted in the Democratic primary. And what they did is they messed with it. And I think of political parties, if you've been working inside a political party for years.
I've worked for the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and you're really committed to them, then you want to make sure that your voice is heard when you're deciding who your candidates are going to be. And in open primary states, Republicans are notorious for screwing up Democratic primaries, particularly if there's a progressive running. They'll come in and they'll vote for the blue dog, you know, or the yellow dog, or the Republican Party. I mean, this is this whole fraud thing that just got busted. Do you remember which state that was in, Shano? I don't know. In any case, it was just in the last couple of days, they busted some guy for, you know, a member of Congress, actually. They busted somebody who was working on his campaign, and they're looking for this woman. She's out and she's in hiding because they had propped up a guy who was a Republican to run as a Democrat in the Democratic primary just to screw up the Democratic primary. And that's what you can do in open primary states. So I'm actually a fan of closed primaries. Does this make sense?
It does make sense.
Because it's kind of like, you know, hey, it's my club. You know, if I've worked for the Democrats for years, I don't want the Republicans coming in and messing in my club. And in the primaries. Yeah. Now, in the general election, obviously, I think anybody should be able to vote for anybody. You know, if you're registered
as a Democrat. Well, right now, what I'm doing is supporting campaigns out of state of individuals, including Bernie Sanders.
Great.
I sent him some money. There's just nobody here, really, that I have any faith in. And the Democrat Party in Idaho just doesn't have any clout at all. It's just really sad here.
Well, you need to show up. Become part of it.
Well, I have, but okay. I feel like it's a lost cause, but I'll keep trying.
Okay. Good on you, Tanya. Tanya, thank you very much for the call. Do appreciate that. Kim in Mooresville, Indiana. Hey, Kim, what's on your mind today?
Oh, Tom, I'm so glad I got through. I just listened to the last conversation you have with that lady in Idaho, and I know exactly how she feels. I'm here in Indiana. Tom, I don't want to take up a bunch of time. My real concern right now is this whole thing in Pennsylvania. And what concerns me about it is, you know, Mr. Obama isn't leading by that much. And I've seen what the Republicans have done in Florida and Ohio. Mm-hmm. And now there's a question about voter disenfranchisement. I mean, what is the question?
Yeah.
I'm 51. I've lived through Reagan. I lived through, you know, Bush Sr. I lived through the stolen elections of the last decade. And now I'm looking at it maybe again for Romney. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I went searching for my people and I found you. And I'm reading Naomi Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at it going, it's happening. It's been happening.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, Tom, I am nonviolent. I believe in Dr. King. I don't own guns. I'm not trying to keep anybody from their guns. But I will take to the streets if Romney gets in. And I don't mean that in a violent way.
Yeah. No,
but
well,
I'm at that point.
I think nonviolent opposition, I mean, this is the core of the Occupy movement, is being, you know, just nonviolently being there. Right. And certainly it was the core of the civil rights movement. It was the core of the women's suffrage movement. It was the core of the abolition movement in the United States. And that's what we need to be doing. We need to be out in the streets, or we need to be joining, you know, movement organizations. I think it was the bonus army that influenced Franklin Roosevelt more than anything else. Washington D.C. was occupied by 20,000 people, you know, they're living in tents all the way down to the Potomac River. For months and months and months. And, you know, he ultimately got them their bonus. But that, you know, yeah, we have to be activists, Kim. I don't see another solution. And if Romney steals this election, we need to be yelling about it really, really loud.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we will be right here on this program for sure. And I'm very, very concerned about what's going on in Pennsylvania. Back, Tom Hartman here with you on Anything Goes Friday. And Joey, listening on WWRL in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joey, what's up?
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, what's up? I'd like to discuss the Libya and the killing of the four Americans there. Now, first of all, there's the law of unintended consequences, and these killings of the four Americans in Libya, to me, this shows why it was a mistake, in my opinion, for us and other countries such as France and Great Britain to get involved in regime change and overthrowing Gaddafi in the first place in Libya. Obviously, he was a dictator, but so was virtually every other head of state over in the Arab world.
No, I get your point. And let me share my take with you on this. The Davies is his name. I don't recall his first name. The fellow by the name of Davies back in 1963 wrote a paper on what causes revolutions. And his point was, what came out of this was something called the J-curve, which is that it's not, revolutions don't happen. People don't go into the streets and start throwing stones or whatever. These don't happen because life is bad. Because life is bad all over the world. I mean, there's 7 billion people on the planet, and 5 billion of them are living on less than $5 a day. 3 billion of them are living on less than $2 a day. Life is really bad for most human beings on this earth right now. And they're not revolting. In fact, most revolutions are revolutions of the middle class, people for whom life isn't terrible. It's just not what they want. So what happens? Why do people revolt? And what is the thing that triggers a revolution? What triggers a revolution is when the gap between what people expect life is going to be like or become like, the gap between that expectation and the gap and the reality of how life is, when that gap gets wide enough, then revolution happens. And I would submit to you that we're looking at the second step of a two-step process. And follow along. This is really important. When Barack Obama went to Egypt and stood beside Mubarak and said, basically, tear down these dictators, the United States supports democracy and democracy movements, which was the last thing Mubarak wanted to hear. I mean, he had to be horrified. And the president basically endorsed the Arab Spring. And what happened? The people tore down the dictator peacefully, nonviolently. And in the process of tearing down Mubarak and tearing down Gaddafi and tearing down in Tunisia, I forget the guy, the dictator's name, but dictator after dictator after dictator, as they tore these dictators down, or at least got them to respond in some way, like with Saleh in one of those countries, in any case, that what happened was that gap started opening up. People started expecting their life was going to get better. They knew, the Mubarak and Gaddafi and these other guys, that they had stashed away billions of dollars offshore. They knew that these guys had palaces and servants and gold chalices that they drank. And so they figured that once the dictators were gone, that some of that wealth would start showing up in the hands of working people or unemployed people. And, after when we took down Europe, in the Second World War, when we took down the Nazis, we came in with a Marshall Plan and we said, we're going to help you rebuild your countries. And we helped Europe rebuild. And so people expected life to get better because Hitler was gone. And sure enough, life got better. No revolutions. But in the Middle East, what happened was people tore down the dictators and they expected life to get a lot better. Hey, we no longer have these leeches on our back. We no longer have, Gaddafi here sucking billions of dollars worth of oil wealth a year out of Libya. So the average Libyan should get some of that money, like in Saudi Arabia, where the average Saudi, if you're a Saudi citizen, you get, $20,000, $25,000 a year just for being a citizen as your share of the oil wealth. So, start passing it out. And it never happened. The government of Libya is really a very small and fragile thing that doesn't even control most of the country. The military in Egypt ran the country before, runs the country now, or at least most of the industry. And they're hanging on to that money. And yeah, they got a new president, and he's from the Muslim Brotherhood, but people are not seeing change in Egypt, and that's why they think that this guy, who's a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, might even be an American puppet, because he's not passing out money to them. We should have gone into the Middle East after these dictators were torn down and done a mini Marshall Plan, or helped these countries to start building schools and start building industry and develop, you know, put into place domestic content laws and protectionism so that their natural local industries would begin to blossom and flower the same way European countries did after World War II. That's what we should have done. We didn't do that. And they didn't do that. And so as a consequence, what we're seeing right now, in my opinion, and I would love to be wrong on this, but in my opinion, what we're seeing is a continuation of the revolution. The revolution has not finished yet. And these people are going to be in the streets until their life starts getting better. And we better figure out really fast that throwing tear gas and rubber bullets is only going to make the situation worse. That instead of bringing in 1,000 Marines, we need to bring, you know, which would cost us $1 million or millions and millions of dollars. We need to be taking those millions and millions of dollars and using it to build schools. And in the process of building those schools, you're creating thousands, hundreds, you know, if you were really aggressive about it, you'd be creating tens or hundreds of thousands of construction jobs and teaching jobs. And now the kids are getting an education. And with those jobs, the middle class is emerging in each one of these countries. And, you know, help them rebuild their economies. We can't just do laissez-faire. You cannot. It doesn't work. Reaganomics doesn't work. Laissez-faire economics doesn't work. Milton Friedman was wrong. You don't just, you know, throw a country upside down, shake the box really hard, let it fall on the ground and then walk away and it will magically put itself back together because of the free market. It doesn't happen. It has never happened in the history of the world. What happens is when you do that, when you bust up a country, it creates such an enormous vacuum that somebody's going to step into that vacuum. Whether it's Al-Qaeda or it's the Muslim Brotherhood or it's somebody who's interested in democracy or whatever it is, they're going to step into that vacuum. And if people are expecting democracy and they want democracy, if you don't help provide them with small-d democracy, and if you don't help provide them with a middle class, and middle classes are not the natural state of economies. Middle classes require government intervention for a middle class to emerge. And people are expecting that, and they don't get it, they're going to be back in the streets. And they're going to overthrow the next guy. And that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for us. It's not a good thing for them. We need to help them complete their revolution. We need them to meet their expectations, which means giving them a middle class, giving their kids education, giving them health care, giving them a shot at the life that they see here in the United States than they see in European countries, which are a lot closer to them than we are. And they see in the very oil-rich Arab nations like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and et cetera. Give them a chance to have that. And we could do that. That could be part of our foreign policy, and it should be. So I'm, you know, anyhow, end of rant. John in Putney, Vermont. Hey, John, what's up?
That was a great rant, Tom.
Thank you.
That was a great one. I was listening shortly, a short time ago with a woman talking about the frustrations and if they steal the election. And
right, here in the United States.
It's going to go into the streets. If they do that, it has to go into the streets. Now, my thing is, if you went into the streets and he gets elected, you know, what's the next plan? And then one other thing is, if it goes into the streets, I don't think any longer you're going to have as much of a peaceful approach when the police start, like they did in the 60s in Berkeley, when the police start bashing heads in. I think it's going to get violent. I don't think there's any way to avoid it. But I'm wondering how would you get him out of office if he stole the election?
Mitt Romney? I don't think you can. I think what you would have to do, and this is what should have been done after George Bush was installed into office by the Supreme Court, and it's what should have happened when John Kerry conceded too early, and in Ohio, and there were still 180,000 ballots that hadn't been counted, and there were huge questions about where the actual votes were being counted. You know, why were the Ohio votes being counted by a computing system in Kentucky that was privately owned and was under the control of Karl Rove? I mean, you know, those were the points at which people should have gotten out in the streets, and people should have been creating so much of a buzz about these issues that those presidents were viewed as illegitimate. And in fact, Bush, for the first 9 months of his presidency, he was viewed as illegitimate. And people did not take him seriously. And people were continuously talking about how he had stolen the election down in Florida by knocking 80,000 African Americans, his brother knocking 80,000 Americans off the voting rolls because they had similar names to felons in Texas and Catherine Harris and the whole thing. And had 9/11 not happened, had George Bush not had George Bush not had that horrible security failure, had, you know, it almost makes you wonder, you know, did he ignore the CIA for 5 or 6 months, ever since the May 1st when they sat him down and said, Al-Qaeda is coming, they're going to attack us in the United States. And he said, oh, no, that's just Saddam Hussein sending disinformation. Really? You know, you almost wonder, did he want us to get hit so he could change the conversation from his being an illegitimate presidency? But that's what the conversation needs to be.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if Mitt Romney steals the election, there needs to be so much yelling and so much screaming, and it needs to be so loud that nobody will believe that he is legitimate, and the next election will change things. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is back in the country. Victoria, welcome back.
Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, it's so nice to hear your voice.
Thank you.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, there are various things going on in the world today. Let's start with around the world, where there are anti-American protests, perhaps triggered by, but I think there's a knock-on effect, the anti-Mohammed film made by a Czech-kiting gas station owner have now expanded to more than a dozen countries.
Mm-hmm.
And they're now including Germany and Britain among their targets, certainly
wow.
In Sudan's capital of Khartoum. In Washington, the Pentagon announced it was dispatching 50 Marines to Sana'a in Yemen to secure the American diplomatic compound, which was partly defiled by really, really angry protesters on Thursday. And in Afghanistan, at a bazaar, protesters burned an effigy of President Obama. So it's pretty serious stuff that we've got going on around the world. And of course, being the Middle East, it wouldn't be complete without conspiracy theories. In Kufa, in Iraq, in a Shiite town in the south, a mosque preacher declared, and I'm sure he's not the only one to say this, his belief that the four Americans killed in the attack in Libya actually died at the hands of the American government to create a pretext for the United States to seek revenge and extend its presence in the region.
Right.
That's not an uncommon, as you know, not an uncommon kind of belief.
Yes, I've spent time in that region, and particularly among the poor masses. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. You know, the working poor and the not working poor. Their conspiracy theories are just so rife. It is
just so
extraordinary.
Rife. Exactly. So if somebody preaches that, people believe that. Meantime,
yes.
Back here, President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, other top admin officials went to Joint Base Andrews this afternoon to pay their respects to the four fallen American diplomats. Mm-hmm. President Obama said in some brief remarks, their sacrifice will never be forgotten and that justice will come to those who harm Americans. Mostly he talked about their lives, but he did say the U.S. will never retreat from the world. Secretary of Clinton, who spoke about them, also warned governments across the Muslim world to control the rioting and the mob mentality and the looting. And she said that Arab Spring countries didn't trade the tyranny of a dictator for the tyranny of a mob.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney has given an interview to Good Morning America and rather shifted his tone. He did not repeat his charge that the administration sympathized with the attackers. He just called the statement from the Cairo embassy inappropriate, which is interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Didn't
he also say that the middle class is people who earn $200,000 to $250,000 in that interview?
That I didn't hear, but I would think he might consider that very poor.
Yeah. Interesting.
She said rather sarcastically.
Yes.
But I have jet lag. I'm allowed.
Okay, you're definitely allowed.
Also, the White House has asked YouTube to review the anti-Muslim film, not they say, as a removal request, but to see if it's in compliance with their terms of use.
In other words, find a loophole to get rid of this thing.
Well, that's not what they say.
Right. Of course, that's not what they say. But the terms of use, typically, I mean, I haven't read YouTube's terms of use, but you look at all these contracts that you know, you have to click, yes, I agree, in order to install the software on your computer or whatever. And they basically all say, you know, we can do anything, we can screw up anything, it's not our fault, you have no power, you can't complain. And so I would guess that YouTube's terms of use are similar to that.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
There is a very interesting report out today by the Global Commission on Elections, Democracy, and Security, which is headed by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and comprises former world leaders and Nobel Prize winners. And it looks at campaigns. It looks at elections, globally elections, and how they're working. And it specifically talks about international elections and what countries are doing and how they're working. And it says that U.S. campaign finance rules have shaken public confidence in the political process. It's also identified a rise in uncontrolled, undisclosed, illegal, and opaque political finance across the world as a key threat to electoral integrity. And it singles out the U.S. as an example of a country where lack of transparency and controls in political finance have left it struggling to restore the public's confidence in its elected officials. And it blames the controversial Citizens United ruling.
And so this is basically suggesting that the United States has or is becoming an oligarchy?
It doesn't go that far, but it does go along those lines. Basically, it warns. I would say it warns. It says the U.S. citizen is one example of flaws in democracies, but because the U.S. is the most powerful nation in the world, it has a responsibility to set an example. It also criticizes states that have sought to introduce voter ID laws. And it says that political finance is an important issue that hasn't received the attention and reform that it deserves. It says we're seeing increasing inequality and we're in a global economic recession, and it's an issue that will only grow. It's not only in new and emerging democracies that provide challenges and have elections that lack integrity.
Wow. And now, what is the organization that said this?
The organization that says this is the Global Commission on Elections, Democracy, and Security. It's headed by Kofi Annan, and it comprises world leaders, Nobel Prize winners.
So this is a branch of the United Nations.
It is, in fact, a branch of the United Nations and will, I'm sure, be criticized for that.
Yeah. Well, you know, the right-wingers, I mean, you know, John Bolton wants to blow up the top 10 floors of the UN, et cetera. But, and he's one of Mitt Romney's policy advisors. It's incredible. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you so much.
Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by free Alabama Governor Don Siegelman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Remarkable. Mitt Romney with George Stephanopoulos. Yes, he says, Stephanopoulos says, is $100,000 middle income? And Romney says, no, middle income is $200,000 to $250,000 and less. Right. Yeah, that's middle income. $250,000 a year. This guy is so out in space. It is incredible. What's also incredible to me is that, you know, Huffington Post picked this up and is reporting it, but it's not on, you know, I don't see it, you know, the headlines of other big websites. It's certainly not on Drudge, as far as I could tell. My friend Kate Kelly, who co-authored the book, You Mean I'm Not Crazy, Lazy, and Stupid, about ADHD back 15, 20 years ago, sometime back. Kate Kelly passed away last night at 7 o'clock local time in Seattle. From bladder cancer, and it's a tough one to lose a friend. So, Kate, if you can hear us, We wish you the very best on your new journey, your new adventures. She was, you know, a person who helped many, many people, particularly in the ADHD community. So let's get back to politics here. Larry in Canton, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. My question concerns Justice Roberts when he was an appellate court judge. I believe it was the Sixth Circuit Court in Washington, D.C.
Well, it would be the First Circuit if it was D.C. I don't frankly know where he came from before he went to the Supreme Court, but that would
okay,
be the First
Circuit. My question also involves the veracity of what I'm going to say, because I'm not really sure it's true. When he was an appellate court judge, a gentleman was suing George Bush, and I believe it was for torture. And he was a swing vote. Prior to his vote, from what I understand, he met with George Bush in an interview for the Supreme Court. After the interview, he came back and voted against the man and, you know, for George Bush.
Yeah, and I remember that.
Is this true?
I remember a case. I don't remember if it was torture or if it was something else. But, yes, there was, and this was something that was raised after. In fact, it came out after he was already on the Supreme Court. So it was kind of a one-day news cycle thing. But we talked about it on this program that John Roberts had a case before him in the appellate courts, and that did involve the Bush administration, and that he was, you know, interviewed by Bush to be a member of the Supreme Court, and he continued to rule on that case. He did not recuse himself as he should have, and so he violated the judge. Well, it is, if you know, and the Supreme Court allows themselves to do this, but every other federal judge in the United States has to comply with the judicial code of conduct, and according to that news story at that time, John Roberts arguably did not.
Wow.
I remember the story. I'm sorry I don't have the details, but it shouldn't be that hard to track down, Larry. And you know, between that and just the very fact that these guys are violating the law on a regular basis. I mean, the Constitution says that the Supreme Court justices shall serve during times of good behavior. And who determines that? Well, the House of Representatives. They get to impeach them if they don't like the way that they're behaving. I think that their behavior has been bad enough that there should be a bill of impeachment placed into the House of Representatives to remove these guys, at least two of them, Scalia and Thomas, from the U.S. And based on this, arguably Roberts, from the U.S. Supreme Court. And frankly, I've been thinking that, you know, that should have been going on, you know, ever since 2000 with Bush v. Gore, which was a clearly unconstitutional ruling by five right-wing justices.
Oh, yeah.
Two of them have already left the court, but it's...
He wasn't elected president.
No, he was not. And in fact, when they finally did the count a year later, the New York Times and this media consortium did the count, they found that if you only recounted the three counties that Al Gore originally asked for, then Bush still would have won. But if you recounted the entire state, which is what the Florida Supreme Court ordered and was in the process of happening when the Supreme Court intervened and stopped it, if you recounted the entire state, that by any measure, dimple Chad, pimple Chad, intentive voter, you know, non-intentive voter, by any measure, Al Gore won Florida. And that was the recount. And you can find that in the old New York Times article that came out right after 9/11. And it was, you know, it was late September, early November of 2001. And the New York Times buried that fact in the 17th paragraph because, as their publisher later told a reporter, they didn't want to question the legitimacy of the president during a time of national crisis. The fact of the matter is that George Bush was not elected president, and he was appointed president by the Supreme Court. Larry, thanks for the call. I want to get a bunch of people in here today. Try and keep these shorter. James in Pensauken, New Jersey. Is that right, James?
Yeah, that's right. How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
I'm a 26-year Teamster, and I'm taking some of my fellow members to task. I've heard you say before that that Republicans have not brought any legislation up for the working man. And, you know, I tell them this, and they seem to get lost in everything. So I'm wondering what kind of ammunition I can use to bring this forth to them.
Well, one of the problems, you're talking about your fellow union workers who have been watching Fox News and have decided the Republicans are the way to go?
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a certain point at which people are so indoctrinated, they've become like basically cult members, and you'd have to do an intervention, a deprogramming. You know, Fox News watchers are, in my opinion, cult members. When you watch Fox News, you get it. This is an organization that's operating like the Moonies, and you know, using disinformation and lies to and selective use of information to indoctrinate people into a worldview that is, you know, rigid and immovable, and has its own immunity to facts built into it. So it's a very difficult thing. I encourage you to keep presenting them with the facts. You might want to check out MediaMatters.org every day. It's a great website, and every day they point out the lies of the Fox did the day before. It's really quite remarkable when you read it. But beyond that, I don't have an answer for you, James. I'm sorry. Jerry in Minneapolis, listening to KTNF. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
How you doing? I wanted to bring something to your attention. Mm-hmm. I had Twittered a few people, radio show hosts, a while back that Mike Malloy is trying to stay on the air, and he needs sponsorships. And I got Norman Goldman, and I got Mike Papantonio to sponsor a few hours. So I was wondering if I could prevail on you to do so and throw support.
Sure. I would be pleased to sponsor a couple hours of Mike Malloy's show. I'll get over to MikeMalloy.com and do that. I encourage others who like Mike Malloy. He's been one of the best and most solid. I mean, I used to listen to Mike Malloy when I lived in Atlanta in the 1980s, and he was on WLS, I think it is, or no, that's Chicago, WR, whatever the big blowtorch station was in Atlanta, and he just did a remarkable job. WSB, that's right. Thank you very much, Jim. Corky in Rochester, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
Well, I watched the TV all day because I'm retired.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Mitt Romney do an interview where he said he would get rid of Bernanke if he was elected
president.
Congress has the purse strings, but Bernanke fills the purse.
Yeah, arguably.
And why would you broadcast that you're going to fire this guy? What does he do? He does a great thing. He goes out and does quantitative easing and says, I'm going to do it every month.
Yeah. And was it before Q3 was announced that Romney said he'd fire Bernanke? Because I didn't catch that interview. I didn't see that.
Yeah, the day before. I don't believe in coincidences. The day before, he said he was going to fire Bernanke. Right? And then the next day, Bernanke announces that he's going to put $40 billion a month into the economy until they start hiring people and putting people back to work.
Right.
Now, he chastised Obama for broadcasting that he was going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan.
Right. But now
in 2014.
Now he's saying he will take them out in 2014, too, unless the military tells him to do something else. Which is really bizarre because our system of government is created where the commander-in-chief is not part of the military. He is a civilian elected by we the people, and he's the one who makes the ultimate decisions. And Romney says, no, he's not going to be the decider-in-chief. That's his job description as president.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, it doesn't get any more bizarre than that. Have a presidential candidate say, yes, I want to be commander-in-chief, but by the way, I'm not actually going to be commander-in-chief. I'll listen to the generals.
Today I might be mad. Tomorrow I'll be glad. Because I'm not driving up my mind.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, Bud, in Clay, Kentucky. Hey, Bud, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm glad to get a hold of you. This is my first call, and sorry to hear about your friend and everything, and your wife's are getting better, I hope.
Yep.
But what I want to tell you is real quick steps that would make you look at what the Republicans are planning on doing with all this stuff in the Middle East. What they want to do is they want to anger the Middle East. Then George W. Bush, evangelical-type people will get all together here in the United States to back this. Then they'll go in and they'll cause an Armageddon war. They'll stone the middle age into the bomb by bombing them with nuclear weapons to protect attacks that they might get going on. And then they'll be able to go in after they get these people, all the major cities be gone. They'll be able to go in and take over all their resources, and they think that's what's going to make America great. Thank you for listening to me, and I wish you'd go ahead and comment on that, and I'll get offline.
Okay. Bud, thanks a lot for the call. I think what you just described is basically the Project for a New American Century, PNAC. It's basically what was laid out by Jeb Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and you know, a bunch of other, and Paul Wolfowitz and all of these and John Bolton, all of these neocons who back in 1998 signed this document, this letter to President Clinton asking him to invade Iraq and to establish an American base in the center of you know, Arabia, as it were, the Arab world, so that from there we could spread our power and we could control that entire part of the world. And I think that right now, if you had President Romney in place, or if we had George W. Bush in place, we would be at war in five or six more countries. And I think you're absolutely right. That is the neocon strategy. It is not what President Obama is doing. And I hope that it is not what he starts doing. I hope he doesn't listen to the neocons. So far he hasn't. He's resisted them for 3 years, and which is a pretty big deal, by the way. You know, I mean, even just to come out and say I'm no longer going to use the phrase war on terror, that's a BFD in my mind. So anyhow, we'll see where this goes. Jim in Philadelphia. Hey, Jim, you wanted to argue with me about Bush v. Gore. Is that right?
I did, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. You and I probably don't agree on much, and for 12 years, you know, I've listened to folks on your side say that, you know, the five who voted on Bush's side in the case were somehow in the bag for Bush. Well, with Supreme Court decisions and all appellate decisions being binary choices, either X wins or Y wins, why weren't the four who voted for Gore, you never hear them demonized as being in the bag for Gore? Why,
well, you're very, very simple reason, Bush. Jim. I would encourage you to go back and read the decision. It's a fairly short one. It's an easy read. And hang on just a second. This was Bush v. Gore. George Bush initiated this lawsuit, right, his campaign. And what he was claiming was that if the state Supreme Court in Florida, which had ordered a recount of the entire state, which was going on, and it was going to take another week or two, if the state Supreme Court's order for every vote to be counted in the state of Florida was allowed to stand, and by the way, the Supreme Court acknowledged that they did not have the right under the 10th Amendment to stop a state from doing what their Supreme Court told them to do. They acknowledged that. They said, this is a one-off. This is not precedent. We're not establishing precedent here. We're basically breaking the law. You can read it right in the decision. And the claim that was made was that the complainant, George W. Bush, would suffer irreparable harm. That's the phrase in Bush v. Gore. He would suffer irreparable harm if all the votes in Florida were counted. It's right there. You can read it. Bush v. Gore. Google it. It's on the Supreme Court's website. And that was what those five justices decided, was that, in fact, if all the votes in Florida were counted, that George W. Bush would suffer irreparable harm, and therefore the Supreme Court was right and it was legitimate for them to stop the counting of the vote. Now, if that's not, you know, tell me how saying, no, we should let the Supreme Court count all the votes, that's not Gore's side. That's Florida's side. That's the side of anybody who believes in states' rights or the 10th Amendment. That's the side of anybody who believes in small d democracy and a small r republic.
In fairness, you know, the first case that came up, Bush v. Palm Beach County Canvassing Board, I mean, the Supreme Court basically handed the case back to Florida. They said, here, you know, we want you guys to do this. We don't want to get involved.
And the state of Florida did.
The
state of Florida did. What they did was they said, okay, Al Gore originally asked for three or four counties to be recounted because he thought that something fishy was going on in those counties. And the states, and that got appealed, right? That got stopped or blocked, and it went to an appellate court in Florida, and then to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in Florida said, okay, we're not going to order that just these four counties be recounted. If there are serious questions, because by that point in time, there were questions popping up in a half a dozen counties or a dozen counties. They said every vote in the state has to be counted, and they were 4 days into that process, and it was happening statewide. And every vote in the state was being recounted when the U.S. Supreme Court decided to take the case. The moment they decided to take the case, that blocked the continuing of the recount in Florida. So it got frozen in time. And once that happened, that ensured that George Bush's win was real. All the Supreme Court had to do was take the case, basically. And then they had to come up with a rationalization to take the case. And like I said, read the case. You will get it. This was, you know, what the Supreme Court ruled was that if all the votes in Florida were counted, then complainant George W. Bush would suffer irreparable harm.
Can I make one other point?
Sure.
On the recount, the thing that the court said, they said 7-2. 7-2 on this decision, that the statewide recount was invalid, and this included two of the liberals, because they were not using the same methodology in doing the counting. So that was a 7-2 decision in Bush v. Gore, not 5-4. There were two separate decisions in Bush v. Gore.
Yeah.
One was 7-2, one was 5-4, and
the first one was 4-9, which was 4-9, which was the decision to take on the case. You can't have 7-4, by the way.
No, 7-2, I said. 7-2 was the recount issue
I would argue that they
that was a violation of equal protection.
Right. I get that, but that wasn't the original argument that George Bush made, and so I continue to believe that the Supreme Court stepped into an area that they shouldn't have, and that they knew that. And when you listen to Sandra Day O'Connor, now that she's no longer in the court, she's horrified by the decision.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And she voted for it. She voted for that decision. And now she wants to take it back. Sorry, it's too late. George Bush has done enough damage already.
Said I just got paid today. Got many a pocket full of change.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman. I'm here with you 34 minutes past the hour. Interesting, Paul just came in and said the guy who called to argue with me about Bush v. Gore said, I just tuned into your show. Right. This is, and then as we go on in the conversation, oh, wow, hey, I've got some more facts. And, oh, somebody just handed me some other facts. And, oh, here's, this was, yeah. It is amazing. Every 4 years, actually every 2 years this happens, but in a big way. I mean, this happened in a big way during the election when John Kerry was running against George Bush and we were on the air. And you would get these basically plant calls. People who would call, and the typical ones are, I've been a Democrat all my life, but I'm just not liking this guy, and I mean, the ones against John Kerry, the ones against Barack Obama, they're virtually identical in their language. It's like they're reading the same script. And it's like, hey, here's $20 if you can get on that show. Oh, well. Ray in Astoria, Oregon. Hey, Ray, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. Hey, I was just wondering, in light of that enormous IRS whistleblower payout thing, we know Romney from the one tax return that he did open up that he had accounts with USB, which is, the Swiss bank. And
right. Phil Graham was on the board.
I was just wondering, if he might have got in on that amnesty for those guys that paid their taxes that they were avoiding.
Yeah, let's explain to our listeners what you're talking about. There was an employee of USB who blew the whistle on the fact that there was something like 17,000, wasn't it, Americans who had UBS, excuse me, not USB, UBS, United Bank of Switzerland.
Sorry.
And UBS had they had over 10,000, as I recall. My recollection was 17,000, but I might be off. Americans who were actually hiding money in the bank to avoid taxes. And he blew the whistle on it. He ended up being prosecuted by the United States government and put in jail. And the guy's in jail right now, the whistleblower. But then as a consequence, I believe, of that or something around that, there was this
right with you.
Brief period of time where you could declare an amnesty. If you were a billionaire and you had money stashed overseas and you said to the IRS, okay, here is what I've been hiding from you and I will pay my taxes on it, then there was an amnesty. You didn't go to jail. And so the question that everybody's asking is the reason, and this was in 2008 or 2009, right? Wasn't it?
Something like that.
Yeah, I think it was like the last year of the Bush administration and it took place in the first year of the Obama administration. Something like, I'd have to go back and get the details, but it was somewhere in that period of time. And there's a lot of speculation that one of the reasons why Romney won't release his tax returns for those years is that he took that amnesty, that he had been illegally invested offshore, he was doing it to hide his income, and that he took the amnesty. Whether or not that's the case, Ray, I don't know. I mean, Larry Flynt is offering $1 million reward for Romney's tax returns. And, he has paid. I mean, he's got Larry Flynt has got the money. I mean, he's got a lot of money. And in the past, when, you know, back when you'll recall, when Bill Clinton was being prosecuted for, was being impeached, and you had these guys leading the impeachment on the House, in the House of Representatives, Larry Flynt said, I'll pay, I don't recall if it was $100,000, $500,000, or $1 million. He was going to pay a lot of money to anybody who gave him solid information that one of those Republicans who was prosecuting, who was leading the prosecution of Bill Clinton for lying about having sex, that they were having sex on the side. And immediately what came out, Newt Gingrich was having an affair with his secretary, basically, who is now his wife. And then it came out that Livingston, Congressman Livingston, one of the, you know, floor leaders of the prosecution or persecution, he was having an affair. And then it was the guy from Georgia. Oh, man. Yeah, Bob Barr from Georgia, that he was having an affair. And, you know, and there was another one that was having an affair. But it was like out of the four or five or six guys, you know, and the Republicans who were leading the charge in the House of Representatives against Bill Clinton for having an affair with Monica Lewinsky, they were all having sex on the side with somebody else, and they were all married. And Larry Flynt brought them down. And you know, Livingston and Gingrich resigned from the House of Representatives. Now, Gingrich resigned more over the scandal of his, you know, the that was leaked by Congressman McDermott, that his phone conversation down in Florida, that he was going to commit a federal crime, basically. But in any case, this, yeah. So when Larry Flynt starts offering money, I would look out. I would submit to you that Mitt Romney might be a little nervous right now. Johnny in Vacaville, California. Hey, Johnny, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. What's up?
I've been listening for a few hours now, and I have one suggestion and one thought. Suggestion is that I'm an Obama supporter, and I'm volunteering by doing some calling for the campaign. I just urge all the Obama supporters to get on board the campaign and help.
Agreed.
Because it's people that's going to defeat the money.
Well, and the Supreme Court is at stake. This is a BFD
election.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Second thought is, I'm a consummate optimist and observing politics for a number of years. We're past due for a swing to the left, number one. But number two, if worse comes to worse and Romney is elected, he won't do any better than George Bush did at managing the economy, because he's a George Bush, as we say, on steroids, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except he has even less clue about foreign policy. My premise is that after 2-3 years, maybe just 2 years, I'm not sure the Republicans would ever be able to win an election again. Because if the economy tanks even worse, unemployment goes up, middle class continues to shrink, you know, after Romney and Ryan's tax plans. I don't know. What do you think, Tom?
I absolutely agree with you, John.
Is that a revolution?
I don't even think it would be a revolution. I think it would be, well, you know, maybe a small R revolution, a bloodless revolution. But if Mitt Romney wins the White House and the Republicans take the Senate, so you've got Republicans controlling all three branches of government, you will see the crash of 2015. You will see, you know, or 2013, in all probability, actually. And you will see the economy, you know, the bottom fall out. It'll be an absolute screaming disaster. And he will be known in history as the Herbert Hoover of this generation. And,
absolutely.
And
I totally agree with you, which is why I called to make that point.
Yeah. And that's actually, you say you're the eternal optimist. Me too.
Absolutely.
That is sort of the silver lining of a Romney administration, is that it might set up an entire generation, much as Herbert Hoover did. I mean, the Democrats held the House of Representatives for 2 years in 1947 and 48, and then they never again held the House of Representatives. I mean, they didn't hold it up until, you know, from 29 until then, or 1930 until then, and then they never held it again until Newt Gingrich came along, you know, until Bill Clinton's administration. So it was like over 40 years that the Republicans didn't hold the House of Representatives. And you know, they only held the White House during the Eisenhower years, because Eisenhower was such a popular figure. Everybody thought he was going to run as a Democrat in 52.
But he was like a Democrat.
Yeah, he was.
He was stimulus.
He absolutely was. And he, you know, he maintained the New Deal, and he you know, wrote to his brother about anybody who thinks that we can do away with Social Security is stupid. And yeah. So, Johnny, I'm with you. Thank you for the call. Very, very interesting. Randall in Nana, Alaska. Alaska. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Yes. Yes, I grew up in the 60s and 70s in Michigan, Detroit, Chicago areas, Lansing, the capital.
Yep.
And I have some information that shows that the Romney family is not as starchy clean pass as it appears to be. During George Romney's election, there was the mayor of Lansing, Michigan, Mayor Max Murningham's family, was a very popular person and candidate in Michigan. It was predicted he would win the election. But just before the election, his daughter was kidnapped and murdered. And the law enforcement said there was evidence on her showing that Murningham was just to get out of the election, and he did. He dropped out in politics altogether.
Hmm.
It was very suspicious.
I remember as a little kid Max Murningham's name. That's all I remember is the name.
Yeah, and I studied it good because I was in debating and all that in school.
This is in the early 60s?
Late 60s.
Late 60s.
Right around... And George Romney won the election without opposing.
Right. Because Murningham was the Democrat who was running against Romney?
Yes.
And he dropped out of the general election for governor? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it was close to the election time and it was said the law enforcement said they had evidence on her that to warn his family to get out of the race and politics, and he did.
That's very interesting. Randall, I can't corroborate that. I remember Max Murningham's name. I certainly remember George Romney being the governor of my state when I was young.
Right.
But
the information should be on the Lansing State Journal newspapers back, maybe if they still have it on record. But
yeah.
When I went to school there, we were taught in political science that we would have rainbow riots, where all the races and cultures band together to purge the government and corporations and Wall Street of its corruption.
Huh. That's a new one to me, too. Randall, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Alaska on DirecTV. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. You can drop into our free live chat room over at TomHartman.com, participate in our message boards, create your own blogs.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rain Koch, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the people at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on commercial radio stations across the United States, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial radio stations across the United States, Europe, and Africa, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones, all the folks at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is genuinely appreciated. Genuinely appreciated. Nancy in Oak Lawn, Illinois, watching on our website at TomHartman.com. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So many things. I really wish I could just sit and talk with you one day.
Okay. Well, pick one topic, please.
Well, first of all, that last caller mentioned, or I should say when you were on break, but anyway, he mentioned about, you know, Obama not being, you know, they're still bringing up all this birther stuff.
Sure.
Wait a minute here. Isn't, because I guess I heard this morning on the news that Kansas governor or somebody is trying to get him off the ballot now?
It was the Kansas Secretary of State, as I recall, and there was an objection to Obama being on the ballot that was put forward by a fellow, I'm trying to remember his name, but I'm blanking on it. But anyhow, that fellow withdrew his objection just a few hours ago. And so the Secretary of State says, okay, we'll put Obama's name on the ballot.
Here's the thing. When are the Democrats going to start fighting back? I mean, wasn't his mother born in Kansas?
Yes.
And it doesn't matter.
And
he
grew up in Kansas.
She was born here. It doesn't even matter where he was born. Isn't it? He's still an American?
Yeah, it should be. Well, yeah, but what they're, you know, whole birth, what you have to understand, Nancy, is that this whole birther thing has nothing to do with whether or not Barack Obama was born in the United States. Just like right now when Romney is criticizing Obama, his surrogates are always careful to insert the word Jimmy Carter in every phrase, right? It's their way of saying, oh yeah, Jimmy Carter had a failed presidency, which I don't think he did, but you know, that seems to be the consensus certainly on the right. And therefore let's make sure that we think of Obama in the same terms. That they're very careful to do that. And you know, so anyhow,
here's my question about all this.
Sure.
When are the Democrats going to start standing up to, first of all, if Johnson would have said something about Nixon right from the get-go, if Gerald Ford was Republican, but at least he was a real Republican, and if he wouldn't have treated us like two-year-olds and said, you know, oh, the country needs to move on, if he would have prosecuted. If he had
at least not pardoned Nixon and just leave it up to the House and the Senate because they were ready to prosecute.
And if the Congress would speak up, same thing with Clinton with Reagan and those guys.
Yeah.
And if the Congress would speak up and fight for us when our, constitutional rights are being, you know, destroyed. Why didn't they speak up to the not-so-Supreme Court when they said that, oh, Bush is going to be hurt by all this?
Yeah.
Obama
did
the Supreme Court.
Oddly enough, President Obama is one of the few Democrats to actually take on the Supreme Court. I mean, in the State of the Union address 2 years ago, he actually came right out and called out the Supreme Court and said, you know, the Citizens United was going to throw so much money into the campaign it would be bad for democracy. And you had Sam Alito sitting there in front of him mouthing the words, "You're wrong," or words to that effect. And he had a spine, but Bill Clinton should have, in my opinion, continued the investigations into Iran-Contra and allowed prosecutions to go forward. There were people willing to prosecute that case, and he put a lid on that. He stopped that. He said, okay, our Justice Department is not going to look into Iran-Contra. And he should have. He could have prosecuted both Reagan and Bush and numerous people in the Reagan and Bush administrations. Similarly, Jerry Ford should not have given this blanket pardon to Nixon. And similarly, and I'm totally with you, LBJ should not have taken to his grave the secret that Richard Nixon was in the election of 1968, blew up our peace treaty and was responsible for the death of 20 plus thousand Americans in Vietnam and millions of Vietnamese thereafter. Because, I mean, you know, here's the clip, and people don't, if you just tuned in and you don't know what I'm talking about, let me just explain real quickly. When Lyndon Johnson was president, this is 1968, and as Vice President Hubert Humphrey was running for election, he heard from the CIA, they had wiretapped Nixon, blowing up the peace talks with Vietnam. Here's the clip. He called Everett Dirksen, the head of the Senate, the Republican head of the Senate, said this.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. Says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election.
Don't go to the peace
talks. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
Everett Dirksen, one of the most respected Republicans in the history of America, saying to Lyndon Johnson, this is treason. I know. So you're absolutely right, Nancy. LBJ should have spoken up.
Ever call any of these guys out? These guys are domestic terrorists who are destroying our democracy.
Well, I would submit to you that we have not had a Republican legitimately win the presidency since 1952. And I'm with you, Nancy. The Democrats should be calling them out. I would love to see it happen. Thank you for the call. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, coming up tomorrow, it's the one-year anniversary of the birth of the Occupy movement, actually coming up Monday. And we'll be checking in on the events. Plus, Supersize No More. New York City just passed a ban on supersized sugar-sweetened drinks or corn syrup. And we'll be challenging Julie Gunlock at the Independent Women's Forum on that. So, and don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. It is not a spectator sport. Get out there, occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.